The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and Kate Andrews. So there are new figures today on waiting lists and the length for routine treatments. There are around 7.54 million in February. And this has quickly led to many saying that patients are still having to wait too long and they are still higher than when Rishi Sunak pledged to bring them down at the start of 2023. Isabel, is it fair to say this is one of those five priorities we hear about less, where perhaps number 10 are the most open about failure?
Yeah, it is. And you've seen today and yesterday, Victoria Atkins, the Health Secretary, and the Prime Minister both being pretty, I think, open about the fact that they aren't meeting this pledge. So Atkins was being interviewed on the radio this morning and said, I don't think anyone could have thought it was an easy promise to make and that it was going to be easy to achieve. Now, that definitely wasn't the tone that Rishi Sunak took when he made those pledges. And the reason I think that you've got this candor from ministers about this is that you've had industrial action. And so there's something that they can very clearly point to, and they have done, that says, well, you know, we could have made much more progress had doctors and, you know, earlier on nurses not been walking out and causing huge disruption. And it is absolutely inarguable that the industrial action has had a huge, devastating impact on the NHS. The question, two questions. One is, would the waiting list pledge have been met without industrial action? I'm not sure it would have done, actually. I think it's probably a convenient excuse and it certainly has exacerbated things. The other is, who gets the blame for this? You know, do you blame the doctors for going on strike, or do you, as polls have suggested, blame the government for getting to a situation where the doctors have gone on strike? This is where the problem is that even if you are candid about failing to meet that pledge, and that's, you know, really the only place that they can go, because they can't insist that things are going well, as they can, for instance, on stop the boats, because it's still in a, you know, a holding pen at the moment as a policy. There are still obvious hurdles to be overcome. But actually, do you still get blamed for being in charge at this point, and for your policies and for your engagement with, in terms of industrial relations, not working?
Kate, to Isabel's point there, do you think that had there not been industrial action, or at least on the scale we had, Rishi Sunak could have hit this target?
I think it would have been incredibly difficult because several things have happened. You have had this industrial action. I completely agree with Isabel. It makes it a bit easier for the government to be more honest about this mispledge because they can point to another body that they don't have control over and say, look, decisions made by NHS professionals to strike at every level, from junior doctors to consultants, have made this much more difficult. But there's another big factor here, which is that you've had more and more people coming forward to the NHS with ailments since the pandemic when they were told to stay at home. Now, this is fundamentally a good thing. If you are sick, we want you to present to the NHS. We want you to get treatment. We want you to get help. But it means that you saw your busiest year in A&E last year compared to winter 2019. And actually, the NHS has been seeing some efficiency gains. NHS England reported this morning that in February, the number of treatments delivered was up by 9% compared to the February in 2019 pre-pandemic. So there's been a lot of effort to see these patients. Certainly, we know that, you know, individual doctors and nurses are doing everything they can to work people through the system to get them seen. But when you have more and more people presenting for sickness, that means that the number of treatments necessary is going to go up. And that is also something that the government could not have properly predicted. I mean, there were forecasts around the NHS waiting list during COVID. We thankfully didn't hit as high as they thought they could go, above 9 million, but they did reach 7.7 million last September. This remains the big problem for the government is, yes, the NHS waiting list is falling, but it's up at the moment by 300,000 from when the Prime Minister originally said he would get the waiting list falling. And that was at the start of 2023. You can't pretend that you've met this target. You can't even begin to pretend you've met this target. And if you did, I think you'd get huge backlash because people understand if they're waiting for a procedure or not. And I think that the tone they're taking is the right one and really the only one they can take in this situation, which is genuine apology. Yes, there are factors out of their control, but they know that doesn't absolve them of what the public think they need to be doing to reduce waiting lists and to get people access to healthcare faster.
And Isabel, how do you think the fairly new Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, is doing? Because we hear a lot of praise these days for Wes Streeting as perhaps the only, you know, figure who can reform the NHS as a Labour politician and as a straight talker without being accused of trying to privatise it American style. But do you think Victoria Atkins has improved the mood music compared to her predecessor, Steve Barclay, when it comes to strike talks or not so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's difficult because I think for both Atkins and Barclay, the block here has not been them personally, but number 10. And it was Rishi Sunak's personal intervention on the previous round of talks on consultants' pay, for instance. I think it was just before Christmas, if I remember correctly, that actually derailed all of that. So to a certain extent, they've been, you know, limited by the interest that number 10 has taken in this. And when you're doing negotiations over pay where the Prime Minister has said in his conference speech that he's not going to improve on the pay offer, then you are in a, you know, you're starting out in a really difficult position, which is why often the negotiations haven't been taking place, particularly with junior doctors. I think Barclay probably got a lot of the opprobrium from the medical world for that, potentially to a certain extent unfairly. But I'd say that Atkins hasn't been blip-free either. The line that she used where she said junior doctors, or as I prefer to call them, doctors in training, normally that is the kind of thing that most people don't care about. Doctors really do care about that kind of thing and get very upset. And I'd say that the one reflection from all of the health secretaries I've interviewed or who are dead, so I've read their memoirs or interviews, is that if you want to get something done, don't insult the egos of doctors from the outset. Now, that said, you mentioned Wes Streeting. He's definitely done that too. And I think sometimes politicians do just get really fed up with the antagonism that comes from doctors who essentially hate the idea of politicians who they think are much less intelligent than them, possibly with some evidence to back that up, telling them how to do their jobs. And particularly with GPs, Wes Streeting has really upset GPs from time to time. And again, over the past couple of weeks, he's been talking very, very forcefully about reform. He's focused his criticism on middle-class lefties on social media. Kate and I both know who he's talking about, which is campaign group Every Doctor. We would have the T-shirt if she was selling them, but I think she's only selling bags and pens at the moment. He's not afraid of winding up doctors either. The problem is that I just don't think that works. And I think the BMA will always exploit something that you say to wind doctors up further. So you need to temper your frustration with the BMA, who are, you know, very difficult trade union to negotiate with. And remember that actually, if you wind doctors up more widely, that can then be exploited and you can end up in a standoff, which is a very emotional one and one that you will lose in the court of public opinion.
From one form of reform to another. what a segue today.
What a segue.
That's what happens if I go on holiday. We now also often hear there'll be no electoral pact between the Tories and the Reform Party. But yet it feels as though some Tory MPs and one Reform MP are almost acting independently. Kate, can you tell us more?
Yes. Very new Reform MP Lee Anderson has said that he's not going to be campaigning against four specific Tory MPs. They include Ben Bradley, Brendan Clark-Smith. And what these MPs have in common is that they're friends of Lee Anderson. And Lee has said that he doesn't want to campaign against his friends. It's a sentiment that I think we can all share personally. You never want to go against your friends. The difficulty is that one very solid position that Reform has, and you know, they don't have a lot of those because they're working on their contract with the people, which they say is always a work in progress. So they're often quite insisting, especially if something isn't costed, that nothing's set in stone. But one thing they are very clear about is the fact that they're not making a pact with the Tories this time. I think it is seen by people like Richard Tice that it was a huge mistake back in 2019 for the Brexit Party at the time to make that pact with the Tories and to not campaign in the 317 or so seats, whatever it was, that the Tories had won in the previous election. And that, of course, helped. It did help the Tories storm to victory. And one of the really big differences about, say, UKIP or the Brexit Party with the Reform Party now is that it is equally, if not more, viscerally opposed to the Tory Party than it is to the Labour Party. And it has been very clear that it is taking no prisoners, that it is not going to be friendly to Tory seats, that it is going to campaign as aggressively there as they would anywhere else. Lee Anderson may well be acting on his own, because to be honest, there are only so many familiar faces within the Reform Party at this point. Lee Anderson has quickly become one of them because he had name recognition before he was suspended from the Tory party and then defected to the Reform Party. So what he does may well have a real impact on Reform's policy, because he's one of the few spokespeople out there making these claims, but it certainly goes against what we've heard from the Reform Party so far.
And just finally, Isabel, is your heart warmed by this story of friendship?
Obviously, yes. I think it's an interesting question, though, because you do get these moments, and it's sort of odd to people outside of politics that people across divides would be friends. But you do get these things in politics where you get to an election and actually there are these profoundly awkward moments where MPs who've been mates across the divide end up campaigning in each other's seats. And, you know, somebody who you might have, you know, had quite a good social life with is in your constituency with leaflets trying to get you unseated because they're in a different party. And, you know, most of the time people just sort of have a kind of all's fair in love and war attitude to that. But when it's somebody who used to be in your party, it can get very visceral, because politics can be very visceral. And if you've joined a tribe and then you leave it, people can get very upset. What I think is interesting is, as Kate says, is that he said that out loud because he thinks it's going to help those MPs. And actually, you know, in talking to you from Scotland, in Scotland, you quite often have these informal, quiet arrangements where, you know, I know Labour candidates, for instance, who stood in recent elections who were actively telling their friends, like their normal friends outside of politics, please don't vote for me. I need you to vote for the Lib Dems so that we can get the SNP out of this seat. And so, you know, you do get that, but they're never going to put that on their campaign leaflet or do a social media post about it.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for listening. And if you have enjoyed this podcast, or if you haven't, but ideally the former, please do rate and review.